The Care Matters podcast is brought to you by the ESRC Centre for Care and Circle, the Centre for International Research on Care, Labour and Equalities. In this series, our researchers welcome experts in the field and those giving or receiving care to discuss crucial issues in social care as we collectively attempt to make a positive difference to how care is experienced and provided. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Care Matters podcast. I'm Dan Williamson, I'm the producer of the podcast and the Digital and Communications Coordinator for the ESRC Centre for Care and Circle. For today's episode, I'm pleased to be joined by two colleagues whom I've worked with for a number of years, starting during the ESRC-funded Sustainable Care Programme, which ran from 2017 to 2021. They've authored a book detailing research and findings carried out during the programme entitled Social Care in the UK's Four Nations Between Two Paradigms. And this is what we've come together today to discuss. Catherine Needham is Professor of Public Policy and Public Management at the Health Services Management Centre at the University of Birmingham. Her research focuses on social care, including personalisation, co-production, personal budgets and care markets. She's published a wide range of articles, chapters and books for academic and practitioner audiences. Catherine led the Care in the Four Nations work package within the ESRC Sustainable Care team. She's now leading research on care systems as part of the ESRC Centre for Care and is also a member of IMPACT, the UK Centre for Evidence Implementation in Adult Social Care. Welcome along, Catherine.
Thanks, Dan.
And we also have with us today Patrick Hall. Patrick is a social care policy researcher, currently undertaking an ESRC-funded PhD at the University of Birmingham on care commissioning. He was the main researcher on the Care in the Four Nations work package within the ESRC Sustainable Care team. Prior to that, he contributed to the European Commission's 2018 peer review of Germany's latest long-term care reforms. Patrick is a former fellow of the King's Fund, where he co-authored two publications on social care for older people. Before the King's Fund, he worked with the Department of Health and Social Care, local authorities and NHS organisations on the implementation of the Care Act 2014. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's nice to see you again.
Oh, it's a very good introduction.
Well, it was a long one.
It was quite a mouthful.
We got there in the end, though.
Yeah.
So, as I mentioned earlier, we've come together to talk about your new book entitled Social Care in the UK's Four Nations Between Two Paradigms. So, what is social care reform trying to achieve in all four nations?
Thanks. So the focus of the book is on England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And we're really looking at the period since the devolution of powers to those, to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland following 1997. And I guess starting with the realisation that we now have four really quite different care systems in the UK. And so what we want to understand is kind of what are some of the key dynamics, what policies have been introduced and what's the learning that there could be across all of the four. So we undertook research, we looked at policy documents, key pieces of legislation, white papers. We did interviews with policymakers in all four of the nations and some of the people from some of the key organisations delivering care and supporting care workers and unpaid carers to really understand kind of what some of the dynamics were and what some of the learning would be. So in terms of kind of what they're trying to achieve, that we would say that in all four of the nations there's a sense that care is in crisis, that this is a kind of long crisis. It's not one which is kind of really seems to be coming to a head and being resolved. It's just a sense that the systems and services that we've got in place were created for a kind of post-war 1945 population that really doesn't reflect the kind of current population. So we've kind of conceptualized this in terms of five care crises, all of which are responding to a crisis of demand. So a sense that because of population aging and demographic change, there is now this kind of strain on care systems. And in response to that, we could talk about a crisis of family. So assumptions that were made about the distribution of care within families have changed. Families, though, continued alongside other unpaid carers to make an enormous contribution and to be hugely under strain and in need of increased support. So we think there's a sort of a crisis there around the role of the family. We could say there's a crisis around the role of the state. The state in that kind of post-war era built lots of institutions, it put things in place to support people, but those were not always supports which really allowed people to lead good lives and were quite problematic. More recently, we've seen the state kind of pulling away and reducing funding, and that's also difficult and has led to potentially what we call the crisis of the market. Lots of huge proliferation of care providers, some of whom are kind of delivering poor quality care, unstable financial models. So we kind of see that there's a problem around the market. And then the last of all kind of crises is around community, a sense that we're all kind of very keen on the development of not-for-profit providers, of kind of natural community resources that in people's neighborhoods and lives that will allow them to move away from that sense of kind of isolation and loneliness and kind of leading good flourishing lives with sense of purpose and meaning, which is really what I think all of us would want from life. But actually there's lots of reasons why community is also under strain, and the kind of spaces and places that people maybe used to go to get that support are disappearing. So in response to that, we then in the Four Nations say that we think that care policy is trying to achieve a number of things, and actually quite similar things across all of the Four Nations. So in all of them, they've got this language around well-being, trying to increase individual and collective well-being. There's a real language about fairness and what's fair in the social care space, particularly in relation to funding, like who should pay, how much should they pay. If you've worked hard and saved all your life, does that mean that you ought to get free care services? And that's not the case at the moment because they're means tested. So there's a lot of discussion around fairness. Rights is another key kind of narrative around the sort of human rights focus around social care, particularly in Scotland. That language is used very much around kind of rights and entitlements. There's something around quality, and I think that raises big questions. Quality for whom? Are we talking about quality care services for the people and families receiving care, or are we talking about quality work, quality jobs? Because those things might pull you in different directions. And then finally, it's about sustainability. Can this all add up together, a system that meets fairness and rights and well-being, to a set of arrangements which are sustainable for the long term and actually meet the kind of the demands that are potentially being placed on it?
Yeah, so there are kind of a number of different ways in which policymakers and legislators have tried to respond in these areas. And we identified six different areas or mechanisms whereby they try to achieve well-being, fairness, rights, good quality care, and sustainability. And so those areas are around redistributing costs. So that's particularly in response to this idea that the system's unfair somehow, that, you know, you could have saved up all your life, you could have worked very hard to, you know, buy a house, and then, you know, all of a sudden it disappears very quickly, you know, if you have to move into a care home. Personalizing support. So this idea that, you know, the state institutions are often, you know, poorly equipped to respond to the needs of individuals, and that actually a kind of a diverse range of provisions should be responding to very particular needs of both individuals, communities, and across different kind of what might be called client groups in social care, maybe working age adults, people with mental health problems, and older adults. Supporting carers. So this speaks to that idea that there's a crisis of family, that there's a feeling across the Four Nations that perhaps family structures are both in some ways doing too much, in that they can't meet the needs that are there, but they're also perhaps doing too little, so that they aren't supported to do the care that they perhaps could do. Investing in prevention. So, that's a big part of the narrative across the Four Nations. So intervening earlier in order to prevent people from developing social care needs. Integrating with health. So that's another big part of the social care policy agenda. Kind of pushing to make the experience a lot more joined up when people have to deal with both the NHS and the health system, and with the social care system, which is the case for, you know, a large proportion of people that go into hospital, often have to, you know, try and get a package sorted out before they could be discharged and so on. There's also this wide worry about professionalization of the workforce. So a problem is identified that the social care workforce is underpaid, has poor conditions, and isn't recognized as a kind of skilled profession. And I think there's a lot in all four nations which is trying to push for a more professionalized workforce. And so that might include things like workforce regulation and enforcement of minimum wages. So those are kind of the, you know, what all four nations are kind of aiming at, you know, to tackle the problems, the crises of family, state, market, and community through redistributing costs, personalizing support, supporting carers, investing in prevention, integrating with health, and professionalizing the work that we're doing in order to kind of serve the principles of well-being, fairness, rights, quality, and sustainability.
Fine, thank you for that. So this book presents for the first time research on the perspectives of social care policymakers on the four systems in which they operate and the ways in which they can borrow from one another. But which of the four nations has made the most progress on social care reform?
So, as you can imagine, it depends kind of answer, because there's a number of different ways of looking at it. But I mean, one of the ways you could look at it is sort of who's gone furthest around some of these key areas that we talked about, like support for carers, like integration with health, like redistributing the costs. And if we do look at that, then we would probably say that in many ways, Scotland is the furthest advanced, at least in terms of its kind of what it's got on the statute books and the kind of legislation. So there's obviously issues around implementation, and that's very difficult in all four. But one of the things that we would say is that Scotland's had the most conducive environment. So we've looked at kind of, you know, what some of the factors might be that kind of make it easy or hard to make progress on care reform. And I think we've said that on the whole, Scotland has had, the most advantageous. It's quite a small polity, so it's had a lot of advantages over, say, England, which is much, much larger, much, much more of a kind of complex adversarial policy system. Compared to the other smaller nations like Wales or Northern Ireland, Scotland's had a lot more kind of institutional stability. It hasn't had the kind of institution building that Wales has had to do, because Wales had a quite kind of anemic devolution settlement it's really had to kind of build on. And then in Northern Ireland, you've had just long periods of suspension of the executive and a real difficulty making sort of getting off the starting blocks in terms of care legislation. So what they've managed to do in Scotland, which we think is probably one of the reasons that they've advanced so far, is have this kind of iterative approach rather than having a big set piece act like the Care Act in England or the Social Services and Wellbeing Act in Wales. They've kind of built up slowly with free personal care coming in around 2002. They've had the Self-Directed Support Act, and then they've kind of built up the legislation over time. And I think we would consider that that's been quite advantageous, because it's meant that some of the people who might oppose certain elements of reform haven't had this big target to aim at. I think we think that there's some advantage really in this sort of incremental approach to reform that's gone furthest in Scotland.
Yeah, it's kind of understanding the social care system as a system rather than just as a kind of, a problem to be solved. You know, that's one of the main messages of the book, is the kind of understanding social care as a complex system. Is one of the most important things when we're thinking about building more sustainable approach to reform, so there are lots of problems. It's difficult kind of responding to a question about who's gone furthest or progressed, because of course the response to that is always gone furthest for whom, and it's like in some ways, Scotland has done the most, has been the most active and kind of had the most, put the most kind of policy attention in social care, but there are lots of people within the system who might say, but what about us, because you can take, for instance, self-directed support, where, although there's legislation, the number of people who are able to access that much more kind of personalized support has kind of really stalled in Scotland in some ways. So, maybe a younger disabled person who's looking for that much more flexible support might say, well, actually, Scotland hasn't gone as far as England in some way. So, you know, it's always difficult responding to those questions about, you know, who's best, who, you know, it's like, you know, who's, it's best for whom, you know, because the social care system's so diverse and the needs of a younger disabled person and perhaps an older person who's frail kind of going in and out of hospital are so fundamentally different that, you know, that question could be answered for each of those people in different ways.
Is there any particular learning from Scotland that the other four nations could take on right now?
I suppose it's quite interesting seeing what's happening in Scotland now with the National Care Service, which at the moment is paused to reforms with the change in First Minister. And so it's kind of one of the things we've been talking about is whether kind of Scotland has got itself a bit unstuck because it's now trying to do what the other nations have done, which is to sort of have this big set piece of legislation where which kind of you just end up maximising the target for the potential veto players. And so you've got this kind of coalition of, you know, local government don't like it, the GPs don't like it, the trade unions don't like it. You know, the sort of family courts at one point were going to be involved and they didn't like it. So there's, you know, you kind of suddenly everybody's saying, you know, the reason why it can't happen, and you get this momentum around it. So I think, you know, the learning perhaps from the other nations and more recently from Scotland is that incrementalism may be a better way to go rather than, you know, we've got this sort of like fix social care for a generation, you know, fix it once and for all type language from politicians. And maybe that isn't the best way to do it. But, you know, incrementalism also has its risks because then, you know, you get, you know, one of the issues which we found was that each sort of successive piece of legislation starts to draw attention away from what went before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're kind of suddenly you're over here looking at integration with health and you've forgotten that you actually passed a bill about self-directed support like 2 years ago. Yeah. And now it's because suddenly things have moved on. So, yeah, there's no easy answer, I don't think.
No, I think that's right. And I think we'd probably strike a little bit less of an optimistic tone if we about Scotland, if we were to write the book again now. And I think it's just that, you know, the guise of those veto players can be different in different contexts. You know, obviously in the Westminster system, that's often kind of comes from within the Treasury, you know, those kind of like parallel forms of government where, you know, they'll kind of, you know, stifle something right at the end of a process and kind of just say, well, there just isn't the money for that to happen. You know, where that kind of siloed style you get in Westminster is absent, we kind of in some ways you'd assume that there wouldn't be that kind of veto player dynamic. But actually, you know, we can see that with them kind of going for this big bang National Care Service, they've kind of created an opportunity for different types of veto players, you know, different people within the system. It's been interesting kind of seeing the response from local government, you know, and from others, particularly the trade unions, are kind of, you know, calling, you know, once you kind of build a narrative around, you know, fairness and a well-funded centralized system, you know, you really have to kind of follow through on the promises there. You know, I think when you're doing something which is a little bit more iterative, kind of focusing on different parts of the system, then that target isn't quite so big.
So I think we're starting to build up a picture of why social care reform is so hard. But is there anything you'd like to add about why it's so difficult?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key issues is how the public feels about it. Because it's one thing, you know, we can talk about sort of some of the institutional barriers, but often it's about the kind of how much political capital are our leaders willing to spend on social care? Because we've just had this repeated pattern in England of kind of politicians saying they're going to sort it. They pass a piece of legislation, which, you know, something like the care cap, you know, has been passed into primary legislation twice now. And nonetheless, you know, it's now looking very unlikely that it's ever going to happen. And partly that's because, you know, the costs, you know, the particularly if we'd had the health national insurance levy, you know, it would have been upfront costs, uncertain benefits for a few people down the line. And so politicians are not willing, I think, to expend the right amount of political capital on it and have the kind of political courage that it takes. So it's something about changing, I think, the whole public debate around it, making it, you know, trying to raise its profile vis-a-vis the NHS, which obviously does have that much higher sort of political profile and public support. And I know there's various people trying to think about how that might be done, but yeah, it is a tricky one.
I mean, it's one of those areas which is so easy to exploit within a very adversarial political system, you know, which is why we've seen kind of, you know, in previous election campaigns, you know, the death tax with, you know, images of, you know, gravestones and all of this sort of thing, is that that's part of the reason why it's so difficult, you know, to deal to kind of, there are lots of kind of psychological reasons why, you know, dealing with social care isn't an attractive prospect for politicians. It's not kind of, you know, a positive and sexy sort of, you know, future looking. It's about sustainability, about the kind of society that we want to live in. It's difficult, you know, it's difficult and kind of involves, you know, negotiation of different interests. So that's the, you know, there are lots of reasons why, you know, I think what we would want to say is that, you know, social care reform is as much about kind of trying to anticipate some of those potential institutional barriers to reform before you even think about what the vision for a social care future is.
Well, thank you for that. So let's talk about the overall contribution of the book. So policymakers can't decide between two paradigms. Do they want care to be more standardized, regulated, or do they want it to be more differentiated?
Yeah, so that's the, you know, is the kind of the conclusion of the book, is that, you know, when we're speaking to policymakers, is that they tend to, when they're talking about a vision for social care, refer to one kind of coherent vision or another. And those two visions kind of come together as what we call differentiated and standardized. So on the one hand, a kind of personalized system, which puts, you know, the service user at the center of what the system does, you know, is kind of commissioned at the front line with very small packages, which are directed by service users, which focus on community assets, community strengths, and so on. And then a kind of another paradigm, another set of narratives, which are around institutional power, about kind of becoming the system, becoming better regulated, more consistent, safer, you know, recognizing and professionalizing the workforce. And, you know, what we want to say is that, you know, there are a lot of tensions between those two things. You know, if a system wants to pursue a very, very personalized system, then perhaps, you know, kind of regulating care workers wouldn't be the way to go. And I think what we see is in the policy documents is a combination of these two paradigms, and they sit together without recognizing some of the tensions between them. And I think that's what we'd like to see in all of the systems is some kind of process for negotiating between these tensions. So thinking about them in an open way.
Great, thank you. Are there any other recommendations for policymakers that you'd like to emphasize based on the findings in the book?
I mean, I think, you know, one of our key contributions is to say, let's sort of face these two paradigms explicitly, and rather than trying to sort of pretend we can have the best of both worlds, say, well, maybe we'll have to make some choices and some trade-offs and prioritise one way of doing things over another. So there's a really interesting exchange in the Scottish Parliament where Nick Watson from Glasgow University asked Derek Feely, who'd written the Feely report, which preceded the National Care Service proposals, he sort of said, you know, very similar to what we'd found in the other nations, this idea of kind of, you know, there's two things running through the Feely report. One's about co-production, personalisation, the other's about kind of regulation and safety and consistency, and, you know, they don't seem to fit together very well. And, you know, Derek Feely said in response, well, but we've got to do both. And that may be true, but I guess what we, you know, what is the missing bit is sort of, well, you know, how do we, what are the kind of conversations, who needs to be run, you know, in what's the scale, first of all, of, do you do this in the Scottish Parliament? Do you do it in local authorities? You know, do we do it at Westminster? So some of these different issues will need to be resolved at different levels. So if, you know, if we're talking about bringing in more tax funding, that's got to be done by Westminster. You know, if we're talking about, what do people get to choose in terms of how they spend their days and how they get supported? Let's make that as local as possible. But yeah, let's at least try and be explicit about the fact that there are tensions here and we need to kind of make sure we've got the right people as part of the conversation. So, you know, if somebody is you know, the people who are using services and accessing support need to be part of that conversation about, well, what should be prioritized. And often when you speak to people about that, some of the stuff around kind of safety and consistency isn't necessarily people's top priority, because, you know, good social care is about flourishing lives. It's about getting out there and having a life. And that might be about saying, well, how do we sort of support people around positive risk taking and being, you know, more kind of person-centered support, you know, and we do know that putting people in institutions is almost never the way to achieve any of those things. So I think we, say that let's try and move away from, you know, assuming that kind of consistency is good in its own right and safety is almost always the most important thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, there are dangers with both, you know. It's kind of like, you know, for a differentiated paradigm, you know, there are risks involved in terms of kind of safety and about kind of inconsistency and things like that, and there are dangers with a more standardized, safe, quote unquote, system, in that it can kind of, you know, make people feel excluded, make people feel part of institutions rather than part of society, you know. So it's about recognizing that actually these are kind of two different visions which exist at the same time in tension with one another. And they're often reflective of different interests. You know, the kind of interests of a frail 95-year-old kind of going in and out of hospital, you know, would be one thing which might involve, you know, a much safer, much smoother institutional transitions, things like that, much more professionalized workforce around them. They might be served much better by that more standardized paradigm. But again, like Catherine said, that wouldn't be, you know, the ideal for the needs of a younger disabled person who wants, you know, to go out with their mates, who wants to find a job, who wants to be included and, you know, and live a kind of a fuller, more inclusive life. And that's, you know, we do have to, you know, in some ways, Feely is right that, you know, the social care system as a whole needs to try and do both and serve both. But, you know, we've got to recognize that sometimes in serving one, you know, we've only got limited resources and we don't serve another community. And that needs to be a negotiated process whereby we think about where resources go in the system.
Yeah, and I think as well, you know, I guess because there has been a poverty of expectations around what older people can expect, we would say, you know, older people want to go out with their mates as well. Let's make that happen.
No, you're right. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole type of conversation that needs to be had. You know, it's like, actually, you know, those who advocate on behalf of older people might, you know, swing towards this standardized paradigm, but actually maybe they're making a mistake in doing that. You know, maybe that isn't what older people generally want. But, you know, I think it's about, you know, having that conversation in a kind of a democratic setting, you know, which is kind of more iterative and deliberative than this idea of kind of doing things, you know, fixing everything through a kind of one-off big bang piece of legislation. We think it's kind of both a mistake in terms of the narrative of it, but also the kind of, the task as well is misguided, because it's kind of bound to fail because of some of these institutional barriers.
Wow, thank you for that. Just before we wrap up, I think Alistair's would be now very interested to know more about the book and where they can get hold of a copy.
Yeah, so it's available on the Policy Press website. There's a hardback and an ebook, and there's two other chapters are available open access, which you can just get from the Policy Press website. So, and we picked two chapters that we think sum up kind of nice parts of the book. So one of them, chapter 4, is about our key findings from each of the four nations. And then chapter 7 is about this notion of the two paradigms and how they come together and their intention and how we might move on from them. So people might want to just dip into those open access chapters, or there's the option to get the book.
And we'll put all the links up on the webpage with this podcast as well, so people can find that. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having us. Cheers.